Session number 7363.
Mr. Jameson, tape 7. You were going to tell me something about German signalling on the Somme, weren't you?
Well, we didn't know what these signals, how they were related in any way, but we didn't realise that while they would put up their lights to illuminate the front at any time, if they were a bit nervous about things. In fact, very lights were standard practice, I think, with the frontline soldiers that carried us back on. They also must have done, I think, a great deal of signalling to their artillery by coloured rockets of sort, or coloured ray lights, because sometimes they would shoot yellow ones up, sometimes red ones, sometimes blue ones, and different things would happen. I can't remember now what related to what, but I can remember that on some occasions when a certain colour would go up, we'd suddenly be treated to quite an amount of shell fire in that particular place. So they must have been able, as a sort of quick emergency thing, to be able to alert a battery with coloured rockets. And we very nearly lost them. Several casualties. After High Wood was taken, there was an old derelict tank, one of ours, in the middle of High Wood, and we thought this was a marvellous job to use as an OP, because if you got in there and you could sit in the little turret and you're nice and comfortable and you couldn't be hit. But on the one occasion when the shell did arrive very close, we realised that the thing wasn't bulletproof at all. The bits began to come through, so we got out of it very quickly, because to be trapped in a tank and get flying metal in it, you might be hit by something that wasn't really meant to go in your direction even. So we got out. And then on another occasion when Drew and I were in coming back through High Wood together with a couple of telephonists, Jerry suddenly, he was always shelling High Wood, and we suddenly dived for a shell hole, and a shell landed quite near to us, and suddenly you would have thought Guy Fawkes had happened. There were blue, yellow, green, red rockets going off in all directions, you see, and we got out of this hole and ran like the devil for another place and dived in again for cover. And everybody all right? Yes. Gosh, that was a narrow escape. It had been obviously a rocket dump. The Germans had been in occupation of High Wood. They'd had a rocket dump in there. One of their shells had hit this lot where we couldn't see them for all the garbage that was around, you see, but the shell had found this lot and alerted the lot. And if we'd been hit by one of those things, it would have just drilled a hole straight through us, you know. There were devilish things like that that go straight through you. Phosphorus bullet. Come in. I've finished all this yet. That should be... I've got to put a cover on there.
Now, is there anything more about the Battle of Loos you could tell us about? You've mentioned the use of gas, the British use of gas, and how this gassed our own men, because the wind was in the wrong direction.
We were only involved in Loos insofar as we were a backup, you see. Again, the trained infantry were carried out the attack. We were in support. We went up to the initial show put quite a bulge into the line. And I have a sort of recollection in the dark of going up to get these guns, going up a pavé road with the French trees that there were, poplars that lined these roads, stuck up, and a lot of them sheared off with shell fire. But we were heading up into a sort of salient. And as we went up this road towards where they told us that we'd find these guns to be got out, we could hear the... we were being enfiladed from different sides with machine gun fire, you see, and you could hear the smack of the bullet on these trees, you know, that sort of thing. You never quite knew just how high or low they were, depending on where they were being fired from. It might have been indirect machine gun fire, because they often used to set up machine guns and fire bursts of indirect onto a place that they thought might be bringing supports up. And it was wet, and it was a miserable night, and we'd taken this party up to get these guns out. And then Weir got into the gun pit and started to fizz around. There was suddenly an almighty crack, and he was groaning, and he was got out and put on a stretcher, and eventually landed up at Cassel in the hospital there. I went to see him after. But we very cautiously approached the situation after that, searching for booby traps and wires and things and getting them cut before we moved these things at all. Eventually we got this battery of guns out that had been overrun by our infantry. Alongside, of course, where our old wire had been, there were still bodies strung on the wire. It was a very costly operation, that, and didn't really achieve anything. I don't think that line really moved seriously until towards the end, when the Battle of Arras took place, years after. Most of these engagements, by hindsight, I would say that most of these engagements, which were intended to capture a high bit of ground in order to dominate the front and perhaps split it open by making it some enfilade position, seemed somehow to peter out. And in many cases, I think in one or two cases, the success of our advance took the higher up so by surprise that they weren't prepared to go on with it. In some cases, we lost advantage because we'd made an advantage which they hadn't expected us to make. And then, you see, unless you've got backup, you waste the initial effort. You might just well never start. I think one or two cases like that happened.
You mentioned this friend of yours who was burned by sitting on a gas shell.
Oh, one
or
of the
effects
linesmen.
Of a gas shell.
Yes.
What were the other effects of gas, apart from sort of direct burning on the skin? Because I know you did describe early on how you were burned.
Yes.
When you were very...
Yes. Anywhere, chlorine gas was like this, that if you perspired, anywhere you perspired, you'd lose the skin. The whole... as big as your hand, you know, patches of skin would be just burned off. And very, very painful to get over.
What could you do? What did you do when that
Well,
happened?
I went, in my case, you see, this was Newport, as I told you. I leapt out and just in a pyjamas, trousers and gumboots and a tin hat, whipping these things off. It was a humid, hot, steamy night. Bonk, 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 doing this sort of thing, and we got everything away. The urgency was to get the horses away. Sequence of events was always horses, men, and then yourself. That was the way we worked. And when you got everything away, I'd got all this loose skin missing from me everywhere. I had to go to hospital and be dressed. And I walked about and walked in a very queer position. But you see, there was always this resistance, and I can come to another case later on. The pressure, the casualty rate in artillery brigades was pretty high. The pressure on casualties was high, and the danger was that if you went to hospital and you were eventually put right, you wouldn't go back to your own unit necessarily. If it happened that some other brigade wanted reinforcements, you'd be sent there. So the fright was to stay with your own unit at all costs. And
even if that meant not going to hospital to get attention.
Well, yes, I can tell you I'll tell you about this again in another event later, perhaps. When we were down. In the south, lying back from Peronne, in the curve of the river there, where it was very swampy, and the powers that be decided that it was quite possible that the Germans might manage to, with fascines and things, throw parties across this bit of swamp and break in through this large nose we'd pushed out. So they decided they would have a couple of guns planted there, and I was given the job to take command of them and put them there. Well, we took them up there one night and we got them in position, and our job was simply to sit there, and then if the Germans were to attack, just blow them to pieces, you see, but otherwise do nothing, and very boring. I mean, I was up there for 3 or 4 days, and I must have gone down with a form of trench fever, I suppose. I know I was pretty sort of stupid and taken back to the wagon line first of all, and left, put to bed, and just kept, and I was in bed in the wagon line for a week, and then I thought I was all right. Got up to have a walk round the horses and just fell flat again. So Drew said, "It's all right, no good, Jimmy, we can't do anything more for you here, we're going to pack you off to hospital." So they packed my valise up and all my stuff, pushed in a jimmy cart, got a driver, and off I was going to this casualty clearing station the way back. Well, we got about halfway there, and I said to the driver, "Just a minute, driver, stop." I said, "We're going back. We're going to tell them that we've got to this place and the CCS has been bombed out, and we can't find it. We're going back to the wagon line." So we went and got back. Eventually I got better. I was scared stiff that if I got there, the wastage rate was over 50% at the time in gunner officers, in batteries, that I would be pushed somewhere else, and I wasn't going. Now, one very curious thing happened. Eventually, after I retired, we went to live in Bracken Rise, just on a bit of Lord Churston's estate, overlooking Tor Bay. And on the opposite side to me, in the bungalow, was a man. He'd been a sergeant in the police, a massive fellow, charming man, and he'd been in the South Wales riots, and he'd been seconded for a job as super when the war broke out, and he joined the services. And he actually went to that casualty clearing station. We were talking about swapping lies about the war experiences, and he said, "Oh, I remember that." He said, "They sent me to that blessed place he said, "You want to just have a look at this?" We were going down to the beach to swim, as a matter of fact. Frank Bennett, his name was, and nice fellow. He'd gone there for an appendix operation, and the doctor who looked at this thing said, "My God, what a lot of knitting you've been having done there. It was terrible." And he said, "You know, well, they pushed me to that place," and he said, "This fellow made an awful mess of it, and then they had to shunt me out because the place was bombed out." Now, wasn't that funny? Years and years after, I'd...
So you had invented the truth.
I'd invented the truth. That the very place I was... we described where we were, and he said, "Oh, yes, I know that. That was the place where they sent me to have my appendix ripped out, and this fellow made an awful mess of it, you see." And he said, "Then in the middle of the show, I was just being patched up when we had to be shunted out because the place was being bombed and had to clear out." And that was funny. I'd been up as an FO in the front line. This must have been probably 1916. I'd been up in the front line. I was walking back in the dark over the top, more or less heading in the direction I knew where the gun lines were by the flashes. There was an infantry relief going on. I could hear the movement and the noise and whatnot around me, but they always occupied the communication trenches for the very good reason, not so much protection, but the very good reason that they would arrive at the right place. They would pick up their guides, because there were always guides planted at certain places when a relief was going on, to pick up the relieving lot and take them up to the front line. Whether they went in the trench or on top depended on what they thought was the easiest way, but that was what happened. And this was going on, and we were walking over the top. I was walking over the top of my two telephonists, saying, "I think we're roughly headed in the right direction. We'll pick up something when we get a bit nearer a few odd landmarks." And I suddenly heard somebody away over at one side shouting out, Over towards me, you fellows. Over towards me. I've got the guide. Come to me. Can you hear me, all of you? Come to me. And I thought, I know that voice. So I shouted out, Chris, is that you? Yes. Who is it? So I said, Jameson. Good God. Chris had been a corporal in A Troop in the Hussars when I was corporal in B, or in 2 Troop. He'd gone off to, before me, he'd gone off to England and been commissioned in the Northumberland Fusiliers. He was back in France at that time commanding a company of Northumberland Fusiliers and coming into the line to take over. And he'd been directing, he'd got hold of the guide and he was directing his fellows to tag onto him so that they'd get in the right place. So we got together and shook hands and said, how are things? How are you getting on? What are you doing? Amazing. Funny how things happen. Unexpected.
Going back to gas again, what other effects were there besides this burning regarding the sort of breathing
conditions? Yes, well,
conditions?
Now, for instance, now those two telephonists that I had with me at Vimy that got the MMs, we were gassed then. Of course, we were very often gassed. I don't know that it didn't seem to affect me so much, whether I was more cautious or careful or what, I don't know, but I didn't get it in my chest. But they did. They went home. They went home with having to have treatment. The only thing that I found was this, that when I came home on leave, it was no good my going to a theatre or anywhere, because in the morning when I wakened up, I couldn't get, my eyes had been secreting something. I couldn't get my eyes open. They were stuck. And I had to sort of grope my way along the landing to the bathroom and get some water and bathe them before I could get them properly open. And then if I went to a theatre or a music hall or a hippodrome or whatever, the hot atmosphere would make them run and I just couldn't see a thing. So the hot atmosphere in a theatre brought on this weeping again, and I just couldn't see anything. Gradually I got rid of that. It took some time. I think the trip to Italy probably did a lot of good.
Yes, I want to hear all about that later
trip
on.
That was.
Before we leave Loos altogether, what was the battlefield like, the sort of conditions on the ground there, compared with Neuve-Chapelle?
Not very different. The ground, the terrain was very much the same. The condition of the ground was very much the same. The weather had been first of all, our first spell in that mud, gradually the weather began to harden up and we got better, and then it wasn't so good, if I remember rightly, just before Loos, but no, oh yes it was, yes, I think that the weather at Loos wasn't at all bad, if I remember rightly, because we when we came out we were lying with the squadron was lying in sort of bivouac formation along a road close up to the support, and coming in at that time were some of the new Kitchener battalions. They'd rushed a lot of troops up to the Loos battle straight from England. At that time I had a girlfriend in England, and her sister had married a Lloyd Surveyor, who was a captain in one of these regiments. I heard that this regiment, and this is where Fanny Burrell comes in, the squadron commander, Eddie Milton had come out with, I'd heard about that he was coming out, and I'd heard the regiment he was with. So I heard they were on the other side of this road, also in bivouac, had just come out of the line. I left word with my troop sergeant, because we were standing by, you see. I left word with my troop sergeant. I said, Sergeant Cook Jones, I said, Sergeant, I just want to go over the road there to to check on that unit. I think that's the NF over there, and I believe there's a fellow that I know there. I'd just like to just check on it. I'll only be over there if anything's happened. We're on 24 hours, whatever. I'll only be over there if I'm wanted. And off I went, you see. Well, I found out when I got back that they'd been in the show two nights before us there, and Eddie Milton had been killed. And I came back, and I was had up before Burrell for being absent without leave, you see. And I said, well, you'll excuse me, sir, I wasn't absent without leave. I know that we're on alert here, so to speak. I know that we were on short notice to move at any minute. But I said, I only went over there to check up on a friend of mine who's unfortunately been killed. And I left word with Sergeant Cook Jones. He said, I never got any information that you are missing. I said, very sorry, so that's... I did everything I could, and I was... And I've only been away for the inside half an hour. Well, he was going to do all sorts of things. He was going to unstick me and all sorts of things, you see. But one or two of the troop officers, he just didn't know his job. Because one of them, Colin Lang, the man I told you about, who was the good horseman, he said, Major, you can't do anything like that. He said, you see, if you try to do anything like that, you've got to hold certain courts, you've got to produce certain evidence, you will be under examination the same as there as he is, and you can't substantiate the situation. You must forget it. So he, I suppose in a way, we all, a lot of my pals there, we used to look our disgust at this man, because he was never there when he was wanted. He was a backroom soldier. If anybody had anything to do anything, all right, they would do it, but Fanny Barrow was never there. Troop officers, yes, they would lead you, but he was away. He'd got a good reason why he wasn't there. One of our troop officers was Harry Amos. He was a leader of a famous band and a most charming fellow. Pots of money. Of course, they all were. They were very wealthy people. But, Fanny Barrow... And the strange thing was, when Colin Lane came to me one day in about September 15, I'd been home before Luce. I'd been on leave, and bad planning, I arrived back on the morning of the battle, which wasn't good scheming at all. But I'd done a lot of hard work beforehand. So, after Luce was over and we were back at rest, more or less, and then we were moving about doing jobs, generally one sort or another. About midway, I think about around about September 15, when I'd been home on leave, I thought, I'm fed up with this war, I'm going to get out of it one time, I'm going to join the RASC or something like that, get a soft job. Of course, there were no jobs going like that. Eventually, I went along to the Northumbrian Brigade headquarters and asked if there was any possibility of my being vetted for a commission. I told Cairns, who was a shipping man on the time, I said, I'd just come back from France. I'd had 14 months there with the yeomanry. I had been in the Elsick Battery at the shipyard before, so I had some knowledge of gunnery. And if it was possible, I'd like to be commissioned in a field battery. So he said, right, I'll take details and let you know. Well, of course, that was at Luce, which was early 15, wasn't it? In September of 15, Colin Lane came along and said, come on, Jameson, get your skates on, get yourself brushed off and buffed. I'm going to take you to the division. You've got to be CRA sent for you. He was the head of the artillery in the division. Oh, so I got all buffed up, and off we went together. And this general asked me a few questions, and, all right, you look likely material, laddie. Go off and good luck. And he was very decent, very nice. And then Colin Lang and I rode back together. He said, well, let's see if we can find a place to have a little drink on this, Jimmy. So I had a drink and some stamina somewhere, and we came on back, and he was very nice. Now, the strange thing about it was that years afterwards, when I was with an artillery brigade, we were moving from one part of the line to another, and it was raining heavens hard. I was in a heavy hunt coat, Macintosh, and a hood over. I had flaps over my knees. It was stair rods. And brigade was in column of route, going, I think, somewhere on the north to some other show that was coming off, and we were going to get into the line. And a general clattered by with a whole troop, you know, following him, all his ADCs and whatnot. And suddenly somebody came and pulled up alongside me and said, "How are you getting on, Jameson?" It was Colin Lane. He was staff captain with this general. I said, "How the hell did you know I was here?" He said, "We have our ways of finding these things out, you know. How are you getting on anyhow?" I said, "Oh, I'm enjoying it very much. Really, it's very, very nice. And thank you very much. I can remember you taking me up there." He said, "You know, the major was going to stop that." I said, "Oh, really? Why?" He said, "Well, your record wasn't at all good, and he was going to, when he got the papers to sign to send you forward for commission, he was going to scrub it." And he said, "I had to tell him again then that he couldn't do that. Your record, there was nothing on your record to show you had been unstuck for anything, any reason at all. Your troop sergeant gives you a good report. You mustn't do that, Major. You'll find yourself in..." So, but very bad grace, he has said to sign it.
I'd now like to look at the story of your promotion, but do you think you could sum up for me the nature of the war in 1915, as you did for 1914? How had it changed, do you think? Had stalemate begun to...
Yes, yes. There were many, you see, we were beginning to get short of troops. I can't remember whether we were short of ammunition at that time, but we were getting short of troops, and we were having this sort of marked time in a way. The Kitchener battalions were coming on, and regrettably, some of them were put out into France before they were really fully trained, which was bad. They were also not intermarried with seasoned troops, so that they were held together well. So that I would say that generally speaking, 1915 was a period of stalemate. I can't remember anything after Loos. I can't remember any outstanding event at all that happened beyond just the humdrum of war. Will this never end? Are we going to... there was a hopeless sort of outlook of, we're here for keeps. This is never going to change. And that was generally the position.